From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Mean Girls and SpongeBob SquarePants tied for the most Tony nominations today. We'll take a look at the nominees, and later we'll talk with SpongeBob book writer Kyle Jarrow. Plus, the new documentary RBG about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg shows the 85-year-old like you've never seen her pumping iron at the gym with her trainer.
He has trained Marines before. He's a former Marine, and he says, you know, Marines, they whine, whine, whine. But Justice Ginsburg just follows my directions, and if I tell her to do a plank, she does a plank.
All that coming right up. The 2018 Tony Award nominations were announced today in New York City. Here's actor Leslie Odom Jr. with the selections for Best Musical.
The band's visit, Frozen, Mean Girls, SpongeBob SquarePants, the musical.
Those last two shows, Mean Girls and SpongeBob, led this year's nominations with 12 picks each, and they're also a good reflection of a Broadway season dominated by shows based on familiar properties and entertainers. From Harry Potter and the Cursed Child and Frozen to Springsteen on Broadway and Summer, the Donna Summer musical. New York Times theater reporter Michael Paulson helped us break down the nominations, and we started off talking about what a Tony nomination can mean for ticket sales.
The Tonys do have a big economic impact, especially for musicals. Wins, obviously, are more valuable than nominations, and the wins won't be decided for another 5 weeks or so. But, you know, it's a big boost for SpongeBob, which has been doing solidly but not amazingly at the box office. And it got 12 nominations, and it will be able to use that in marketing materials. On the other hand, there's a musical now on Broadway called Escape to Margaritaville, which is from Jimmy Buffett. And it got shut out in the nominations. It's already been doing kind of poorly at the box office, and it's bad news for them.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in the musical race, where you have a critic's favorite, The Band's Visit, up against three shows that probably aren't as well reviewed but are very popular with audiences, that are Mean Girls, SpongeBob SquarePants, and Frozen. Is that kind of an unusual pairing in this year, where you have this critic's darling against these bigger, more commercial hits?
It is. Arguably, there's sort of a tension between art and commerce this year. We're seeing a huge number of blockbuster titles on Broadway at the moment. As you may know, the bulk of ticket buyers are tourists, and they tend to gravitate toward familiar titles as they try to make decisions about what to see. So lots of movie studios, lots of record labels are looking for stuff they can adapt for Broadway. But as you say, the critic's favorite is a musical called The Band's Visit, which is adapted from a small Israeli film from 2007, much less well-known and much more critically praised.
Let's talk a little bit about Angels in America, the 25th anniversary production, I think is now the most Tony-nominated play in history.
That's right. This revival got 11 nominations, which is more than any play has ever received in history. It's kind of amazing. It's a starry production. It features Nathan Lane and Andrew Garfield. You know, it's an endurance test for theater lovers. It's 7.5 hours long. You see it in two parts. But it's also a thrill for people who love that kind of thing. It won the Pulitzer and two Tonys in its original production in the early 90s. And, of course, it's being revived not only on Broadway at the moment, but also in Berkeley.
There's another very well-reviewed show that didn't get any nominations, and I suspect there's something behind that, and that is Bruce Springsteen on Broadway. What happened there, and what happens to Bruce going forward?
Yeah, so Bruce Springsteen has been on Broadway since last fall, and he's having a great time. He's staying until this December. It's almost a one-man show. His wife joins him for a couple songs, but he tells stories about his life, and he sings kind of stripped-down versions of his most popular songs. Critics loved it. Audiences are loving it. It's a sold-out production, but he decided not to compete for Tony Awards, and the way he did that is by not inviting the Tony voters, which automatically disqualifies you. So the Tony administrators decided as an alternative that they would give him a special Tony Award in a recognition of his contribution for the season, and they're hoping that he will then perform on the awards show. As you may know, awards shows generally have been doing less well on television recently. The ratings have been going down, and so it's important to have big stars performing to help shore up the viewership.
You have noted that just as in Hollywood, women tend to be really underrepresented as decision makers on Broadway, as producers, directors, and writers. Did Tony voters at least recognize some of the few women who have prominent positions in Broadway productions in the current season?
Yes, of course. We think of women in theater as performers, and they're doing well there, but they're much less well represented in the places where the jobs require controlling budgets and overseeing large groups of people. But this season, they seem to be doing a little bit better, in large part thanks to the Harry Potter play. Of course, Harry Potter is the creation of J.K. Rowling, and she is a lead producer of the play. And then Sonia Friedman, who is the most powerful producer in London, is another lead producer of that play. There are also a number of women playwrights who were nominated, and two women directors, one for the revival of Angels in America and one for the new musical SpongeBob SquarePants.
I'm going to ask you about Harry Potter and the Cursed Child because it got a nomination that is typically reserved for a musical, and that is for Stephen Hoggett's choreography. He is an amazing choreographer. How does he get nominated for Best Choreography in a non-musical?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, in many ways, has the structure of a musical. It's really big. It has a huge cast of 40 performers and a huge set and a lot going on. And it incorporates what is sometimes called physical theater. So there's a lot of very highly stylized movement that very closely resembles dance. And the nominators chose to recognize that with a choreography nomination.
Last year's Tony Awards were hosted by Kevin Spacey. It's so hard and yet easy to forget that fact. Obviously, that turned into a story unto itself. Spacey subsequently was caught up in a horrible sexual assault and harassment scandal. Did the Tony organizers maybe play it a little safer this year? Who is going to be hosting this year's ceremony?
This year, they went for two extremely well-known songwriters, singers, Josh Groban and Sarah Bareilles. Both of them are best known as concert performers and recording artists, but they have both recently come to Broadway for the first time. Josh Groban, who was a theater kid before he turned to pop music, did a musical called Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, and Sarah Bareilles wrote a musical called Waitress and then starred in it for a while.
Michael Paulson covers theater for the New York Times. Michael, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Let's make a new one, Mama. What do you say? I love you when you let me pick out the name.
Coming up, Ruth Bader Ginsburg goes from the Supreme Court bench to a bench press in the new documentary, RBG. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. While The Avengers Infinity War may continue to lure millions more ticket buyers this weekend, there's a documentary hitting the multiplex on Friday that's about a real-life superhero. At least that's how the filmmakers and a whole generation of female lawyers view their subject. She's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The Supreme Court justice garnered rock star status a few years ago when the Tumblr notorious RBG made her a pop culture icon. In RBG, we learn that long before she joined the Supreme Court, Ginsburg was a lawyer who argued cases before the court, and many of them had to do with gender equality. Betsy West co-directed RBG with Julie Cohen, and when I reached West in New York, we started with a kind of sexist discrimination that Ruth Bader Ginsburg faced as a student at Harvard Law School.
It's kind of amazing what she went through not so long ago, really, in the mid to late 50s. She was at Harvard Law School, and she was one of 9 out of 500 men. She had to run across the courtyard to get to the ladies' room. There was a library that was off limits to women. It was just like, no way. And as she tells us in the documentary, she really felt as if everyone was watching her. You know, you were on display as a minority and one of 9 women in that big class. But despite that, I mean, she was at the top of her class, and she was on the Harvard Law Review. Then she transferred to Columbia her last year because her husband had moved to New York. She graduated at the top of her class at Columbia. And yet, when she went out into the job market, she couldn't get a job.
Yeah, this isn't unconscious bias. This is conscious bias where the fact that you were a woman was like all you needed to be told no.
Yeah, and it was just very easily expressed. She's a woman. We don't hire women. End of sentence. That's it.
And the thing that she did is that she didn't get mad. She got even.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. She talked to us, to my directing partner, Julie Cohen, and I, about the lesson that she learned from her mother at a very early age, which was anger is a waste of time. And I think by that she means not that she wouldn't get angry, but that she would move beyond it and try to figure out a way around it. And in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's case, after she was discriminated against and kept out of jobs and denied an opportunity to be a clerk on the Supreme Court because she had been recommended to a justice on the Supreme Court who said, I'm not going to hire a woman. Within a decade of all the discrimination that she faced, she was part of this movement to change the discriminatory laws and customs in our country. And ultimately, she brought a series of lawsuits that really did force the Supreme Court to look at this discrimination that was out there that people really didn't recognize as discrimination. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg brought it to their attention and had a tremendous impact on every woman in this country.
There is an audio recording that you have of then a private lawyer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, appearing before the court. And she's arguing a case, and I think it's Chief Justice William Rehnquist who says, isn't it enough that Susan B. Anthony is on a coin?
Equally before the law.
You won't settle for putting Susan B. Anthony on the new dollar.
And it's not clear that he's totally joking.
Yeah. The kinds of casual, you could say, sexist remarks that were made to her in the course of her work as a litigator appearing before the Supreme Court. And we asked her, we played her, actually, I guess we didn't play it for her, but we asked her about several of the comments that we heard on these audio tapes that the Supreme Court keeps of all the arguments. We asked her, how did you deal with this kind of dismissive remark? And her response characteristically was never in anger. And then my favorite comment that she made was, I almost felt as if I were a kindergarten teacher explaining to these justices that, yes, discrimination against women exists. And it was Justice Ginsburg then as a lawyer, so it was Lawyer Ginsburg, who was explaining to justices, no, you know, women don't have it all. They're not on a pedestal and treated better. The pedestal is often a cage.
We're talking with Betsy West, who, along with Julie Cohen, directed RBG. It seems to me there would be kind of a fundamental difference between saying we need to make a documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg to how do we make a documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Because you have to, if you're going to do this well, probably get her cooperation, and Supreme Court justices are famously private. So how did you negotiate that part of the story where you tell Ruth what it is that you want and make sure that she's comfortable with what it is that you need?
Well, it was a step-by-step process, let's put it that way. Julie Cohen and I started about 3 years ago. We proposed to Justice Ginsburg that we would like to do a documentary about her life story. And at the time, she said, well, I'm not ready yet. So then we went back at her again a few months later with another proposal saying that we would like to, wouldn't want to interview her right away, but we'd like to talk to her former clients and her colleagues and her family just to get the process going. And she said, well, that might be possible. And, perhaps in a few years, I'll be ready to give you an interview. So we slowly got closer and closer. And eventually, 2 years ago, she gave us the green light to go ahead and to film her at some of the events that she does around the country where she speaks to legal groups. And eventually we filmed with her, with her granddaughter, with her family behind the scenes at an opera where she had a speaking role. And then the most fun thing, filming Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her gym doing her legendary workout routine.
Yeah, that trainer is Brian Johnson, and we see him putting her through some moves that it's clear he's not really pulling punches. He is giving her as hard a workout as she can do.
Believe me, she does. It's just all business. She goes in there and Bryant tells her what to do and she does it. As he says, he has trained Marines before. He's a former Marine. And he says, you know, Marines, they whine. But Justice Ginsburg just follows my directions. And if I tell her to do a plank, she does a plank.
I think it's safe to say that when you started this documentary, the world was different than it is today. We did not see the election of Donald Trump, the defeat of Hillary Clinton. We didn't have all of these reports about sexual harassment and assault and rape across popular culture and into government. How do you think that changes the way that her story is relevant and the way your film will be received?
Well, excuse me. I think that what's happened in the past year certainly does change the landscape, and it makes our film more relevant in a way, because I think our film and the story of Justice Ginsburg is a context that people need to understand, that it wasn't so long ago that women weren't even allowed into many workplaces. It was a hard-fought battle for women to get the right to use their brains and to contribute their talents to our country. And yet we're learning that sexual harassment and in some cases violence has kept women from really contributing. So it's another stage in a long battle for equal rights for women that's been going on for over a century. Ruth Bader Ginsburg played an enormous role in winning rights for women.
A couple of years ago, I was fortunate enough to go to the Supreme Court and hear oral arguments. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a tiny woman. She doesn't have a booming voice, but her questions were remarkably astute. She knew this case backward and forward. She's now 84, I believe. What do you think keeps her going?
She loves the law. She absolutely loves it. And that's been the case ever since she was a student at Harvard Law School. Her children talk about waking up in the middle of the night and going into the kitchen, and there was Mom on the dining room table with all the papers spread out, and she's writing into the wee hours. That's still the case, we're told, that she really is a night owl. She is very well prepared, from what I'm told. You come into that courtroom and Justice Ginsburg has read everything. She certainly has a steel trap memory. We saw that when we interviewed her. Her memory for the clients, the cases, the details of the cases that we were talking to her about. She actually corrected us on one thing at one point. She's got an extraordinary memory, and I think she figures as long as that's the case and she's capable of doing the job, she has no intention of stepping down.
Betsy West, along with Julie Cohen, is the director of the documentary RBG. Betsy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, John. Great to talk to you.
RBG opens in theaters on May 4th. Coming up, we talk with the writer of the SpongeBob musical. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Who would have guessed that a musical about a talking sponge living in a pineapple under the sea would be the toast of the Tonys? As we mentioned earlier in the show, SpongeBob SquarePants the musical snagged 12 Tony nominations today, tying for the most of any show. The nominations included the top prize for Best Musical. It took more than 8 years to put the musical together, and you won't see a giant foam suit or inflatable starfish anywhere in the show. Instead, the characters are played by actors in colorful clothes who embody the hopeful, uninhibited spirit of the inhabitants of Bikini Bottom. Playwright Kyle Jarrow wrote the book for the musical. I caught the show back in December, just as it was opening, and I asked Jarrow to explain the immense popularity of the SpongeBob franchise.
Optimism and surrealism. SpongeBob is this naive character.
Secretly, I'm a little bit naive.
Wow. I'll never look at you the same way again, SpongeBob. Gosh.
He's sort of a classic, we see that character throughout literature, throughout film. Always happy, always optimistic character in a really messed up world. And that's where a lot of the comedy comes from. And I think that's also why he is so incredibly lovable. He always sees the bright side. And then the world is super surreal, right? You've got a sponge living in a pineapple. His pet is a snail who meows. They live in a town that is called Bikini Bottom. It's a completely surreal, completely bizarro world where really anything can happen and anything does. Basically, what we decided to do is take SpongeBob to its most absurd extreme, which is, what is the most absurd situation to be optimistic in? It's the apocalypse. So our show, we like to sort of think of it as Armageddon meets SpongeBob meets Our Town. And it's about this town, Bikini Bottom, basically facing apocalypse. There's a volcano that is going to erupt and going to destroy everyone. And a situation like that seems like the most absurd scenario to put an always optimistic character in the middle of. So that's what we did.
I'm going to give you a list of musicians who have nothing in common. They might be giants. John Legend, Lady Antebellum, Steve Tyler and Joe Perry from Aerosmith. David Bowie, Panic at the Disco, the list goes on. They have nothing in common except they're musicians and what?
Well, a lot of them are SpongeBob fans.
And they all have songs in the show.
And they all have songs in the show. Yeah, you know, what we did when we made this show is we, you know, broke out what the story was going to be. We figured out where the song spots were going to be. And we said to ourselves, who would be the most awesome band or artist to write a song for this spot in the show?
Let me have adventure, be a contender.
So we basically went to him and we're like, hey, we love Panic at the Disco to write a song for this moment. Can you connect us with them, with their manager, whatever? And in almost every case, the bands said yes. And the reason was so many of them were SpongeBob fans. They'd either grown up on it, Panic at the Disco being an example of that, or like Aerosmith, they have kids or grandkids who are fans. Unbelievable. Like, we didn't think Aerosmith would write a song for us, and it was such an
easy... How
about
David Bowie and Brian Eno?
I know. Well, that is actually the one song that is not original.
Okay.
It is a rearrangement of a song called No Control, which is a B-side.
The end is in our future. Evidence has come to light. It's all deranged. No control.
What we were told is Bowie loves SpongeBob. He actually has been a voice on the TV show.
Yeah.
They would love for you to use a song, but he's not going to be able to write a new one. We sort of now, in retrospect, know it's probably because he was ill. But really honored that they let us choose a song and include it.
I'm going to read you a couple of lines from your book, Angry Mob. Blame the squirrel, blame the squirrel, blame the squirrel, blame the squirrel. Sandy hides, evading the mob. Once they're gone, she steps into the clear. She looks over to see two fish in fedoras spray painting a wall with the words, land mammals, go home. They stare her down, then go. Sandy is crushed. She says sorrowfully to herself, I thought this was my home. Guess I was wrong.
Sandy the squirrel, for people who don't know the TV series, is a squirrel who wears an astronaut helmet so that she can breathe underwater. She is there to study the fish. You know, Bikini Bottom is an incredibly diverse place. And we're exploring what happens when that incredibly diverse place feels that it is under threat. And it just didn't feel right to tell that story and not explore one of the things that can and often does happen when a community experiences threat, which is people get scapegoated. The piece is not political, but I'm not going to lie. We live in a time where we're a really divided country. And I think there's a way to tell some stories with fish that you maybe would have trouble telling with people because they would feel really divisive and really aggressive. And I think there's a way to tell some stories with surrealism and optimism and a bunch of fish and crazy costumes that let you talk about some serious things, but do it in a way that almost everybody can connect with and not feel threatened by. And if you can tell a story that people on both sides of the aisle can connect to and say, yeah, you know what? Scapegoating somebody just because you're really scared isn't the right thing to do. I feel like that's a powerful message to make.
Kyle Jarrow is the book writer for SpongeBob SquarePants, the Broadway musical. Kyle, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. Been my pleasure.
The Tonys will be handed out on June 10th in New York. And that's all for today. And remember, you can follow The Frame on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.
Stuck inside with no TVs.